Okay, I would now like to introduce to you the main speaker for this meeting, Amy Art. What are you doing, Hyde?
I'm good, how are you?
Good to see you.
You too. Oh my goodness, up here?
Yep, it's all yours.
Did you take my notes? Oh yeah, here you go. I brought some notes here to help me through my... No, I'm just kidding. Those are mine. Anyway, hi everybody, my name's Amy, I'm an alcoholic. I really appreciate you guys being here tonight. You know, never in a million years did I ever think I would be up here as a speaker. Excuse me. You know, and I'd like to welcome all the newcomers first. And I also want to thank all the people that came specifically, you know, to support me tonight. I appreciate that. And, I mean, that means the world to me and the rest of you. Sorry. I'll try to keep it short. But anyway, I did actually bring some notes because, you know, I need to... I had a lot of fun drinking, but I've had a lot more fun sober. So I need to kind of, you know, keep myself on task. So I have a couple notes here. But, you know, I just want to, you know, just start out, like I said, by thanking everybody for allowing me to be up here. I got sober. My sobriety date is June 10th, 1990. I got sober in Pacific Beach, the Dawn Patrol of my home group. Matter of fact, I had to laugh when Paul was talking. I lived in all those places. I think I probably went about the same time he did and moved to all those different places. But, you know, I got sober in PB, and I used to go to the La Jolla speakers meeting. And I remember I was petrified to even go there, let alone think about being a speaker. You know, I mean, just I was just so nervous because everyone was dressed up, and, you know, it just freaked me out, you know. And so to be standing here is truly an honor. It's really an honor. And, you know, I'm not so nervous about being up in front of people. I think I was most nervous about the dress code. Because Randy kept emphasizing how important it was to, you know, it's okay to dress casual, just not Amy casual. Because I have, you know, my sweats, and then I have my dress sweats, you know. So, it's a big deal, you know. And so, I'm honored to be up here. And also, I've done a lot of H&I panels and stuff, and... one time I showed up, I was like 10 years sober, and I showed up for this one at McDonald's Center, and I showed up in my flip-flops and shorts and like a, you know, ragged T-shirt or whatever, and this girl that had like 9 months sober, she looked at me and she goes, "You're going to go like that? You got to give them some hope, you know?" So anyway, so that's why I dressed up. So, okay, enough about dress. Again, sobriety date, June 10th, 1990. You know, I got to tell you, I earned my seat here. It may be a little bit different than what you guys have done, but I definitely belong here. And, you know, just, I guess I'll just start by, you know, kind of chronologically and tell you my story. You know, I grew up, actually, I didn't grow up. I still haven't grown up. I was born into an alcoholic home. My father was an alcoholic. He's kind of one of those violent, raging, you know, one that we've all seen, raging drunks. My mom wasn't, but my dad was. And, you know, and then at age five, you know, I have a few memories of that, but, you know, mostly I was pretty young. And then about age five, my mom, you know, she kicked him out or whatever, and my mom met and married a normal guy, you know. He was hardworking, intelligent, you know, normal, all those things. I mean, he's the type of guy that started his retirement at age 15. And, you know, it was just such a complete switch in black and white, you know. And we moved out to the suburbs. This was back in Michigan. I grew up in Michigan. And moved out to the suburbs. I had absolutely, truly the best childhood, you know, just about anybody could ask for. I mean, it was safe. I went to good schools. We didn't have a ton of money, but, you know, I had food on the table. I had a roof over my head. I had all those things, you know. Nobody was an alcoholic. We drank and told Pollock jokes at holiday dinners, but everybody had fun, you know. I mean, I was a kid, but, you know, everybody drank, but it was just fun, you know, it was a lot of fun. And so here I am, an alcoholic, and, you know, I've often wondered, and not so much anymore, but I often wondered earlier on, especially in early sobriety, you know, how the hell did I become an alcoholic, you know? I mean, nobody in my family is an alcoholic, And I shouldn't say nobody, but, you know, there's some heavy drinkers, but nobody that was a non-functional alcoholic. And, you know, so I battled back and forth for a long time as to, you know, I tried to blame my parents, tried to blame my upbringing. I was grounded a lot, so I blamed that. You know, I was never, I don't know, a star athlete. I tried to blame all those things, you know. And the bottom line is that I was born an alcoholic. I was born with the ism, is what I was born with. And, you know, I started out with my earliest memories. Some of my earliest memories, I felt lonely, apart from, disconnected, not a part of, not good enough. You know, all those things that we feel. All those things that we feel. And that was like age 4. You know, those were some of my earliest memories. So, you know, I had spent a lot of my life trying to fill that void, you know, and absolutely no connection with my spirit, you know, none whatsoever. And I grew up just wanting to be anybody but me, you know, and I just tried to fit in. I tried to be the funniest person. I tried to be the star athlete. I tried to be the prettiest girl in the crowd. Mind you, I never accomplished any of these things, but, you know, at least I tried. It wasn't for lack of trying. And, you know, I mean, I just had that feeling that we all know very well. And, you know, I tried to fill it in a lot of different ways. And, you know, I'm gonna just mention this part because it is a big part of my story. You know, I started at age 11, 12 with an eating disorder. You know, I started to become bulimic and eventually got to the point where I was severely bulimic. But, I mean, it just, you know, so I started the destruction of my spiritual self pretty early. You know, pretty early on. You know, I had my first beer when I was 12. You know, my cousin gave it to me, and it was one of those, Miller something or other. Kind of looked like urine in a bottle. It was a clear bottle. And I just remember, you know, I was so exhausted. Like, when I look back, I just think it was so exhausting trying to be the best, trying to be this, trying to be that, and trying to just be the center of attention all the time. And I had this beer, and it truly was like, just relaxation. You know, it's kind of like that feeling you get when you're swimming in the ocean and you pee in your wetsuit. You know, it's just kind of like, you know, just that warmth that goes all over you. And it's just awesome, you know. And it was just like this warm, safe feeling. And turns out I didn't pee in my wetsuit, but, you know, not that I would know. I've heard that. But it was just kind of one of those feelings where it was just like relief. I don't know. It was just relief. And, you know, I didn't immediately then start with the drinking or anything. It was just kind of a one-time experience. But I do remember that was a profound experience for me. You know, I just thought, wow, that's pretty cool. And, you know, watching TV, you know, and just thinking about, I couldn't wait till I remember saying this to my family, I can't wait till I'm old enough to go to a disco because I wanted to drink. And does that tell you how long ago that was? Because I wanted to drink and I wanted to dance, and they just looked like they were so carefree, and that's just not what I felt. You know, we had alcohol in the house, but, you know, again, my family wasn't big drinkers, whatever. But my first drunk, I do remember that very well. My first drunk, I was like right around ninth grade, and it was a summer night, you know, or spring night, whatever, getting ready to go play tennis after dinner with one of my friends. Didn't, you know, my family didn't drink. You know, I just happened to be standing on the phone next to the alcohol cabinet, and, you know, she didn't drink. I didn't hang around people that drank, none of that, you know, and nothing happened. It just all of a sudden possessed me to fill this, you know, those squeeze ketchup bottles with, you know, that you take to a picnic. I just stood there while I was on the phone and filled it with every type of alcohol my parents had in the liquor cabinet. You know, it was like this much clear alcohol. And I just drank it while I was on the phone. And, yeah. So, which it surprised me that I ever took another drink again, because first of all, it tasted like sweaty socks. And second of all, it tastes even worse coming up again and again and again, you know. But I got very drunk, and everyone was, I just remember, you know, the kind of the aftermath, and again, in hindsight, everyone's just so surprised because it just wasn't a part of my life, you know, and it wasn't anything that I'd think of, but I just did it for no reason, and, you know, I got in trouble, and, you know, all that stuff, a serious hangover, and, but for me, the most serious consequence about that was that it awakened the compulsion, and I didn't like it. I didn't like the taste. I didn't like how it made me feel. It just created this obsession, you know, and this compulsion to drink and to drink alcohol or to drink liquor. You know, I didn't want to get drunk because it made me feel good. It just, I had to ingest it. It's like I could feel it in every pore of my body where I just needed it. And it was just so bizarre. You know, it was such a bizarre thing. But so I started sneaking into people's houses, friends, you know, and sneaking into their houses and stealing liquor, stealing food, whatever. And, you know, I came from a good home. My parents taught me not to steal, you know, but whatever. They should have put their effort into how to teach me how not to get caught. That would have been a lot more effective. So anyway, you know, my best friend had older brothers, and her parents had a lot of alcohol around too, but they, unbeknownst to me at the time, put scotch tape on it so they could measure the amount of alcohol because they were, you know, wary of their older sons. And so we blamed it on them, of course. But so anyway, so it just, that just, it just possessed me. And then right around, you know, age 16, 17, I started social drinking. You know, that was, I was doing it by myself. That was the first thing I was doing was first, my first way of drinking was doing it by myself and just sneaking into people's houses. And then I discovered social drinking. And that was a lot more fun. I mean, that made me, that filled that void. That made me feel a part of. It made me feel pretty. It made me feel just happy and free, you know. And growing up in Michigan, we had those paper licenses that you could change. And the drinking age was 18. And so we used to sneak into clubs and, you know, change our license and sneak in. And, you know, the drinking part just added to the whole experience. It made me, whenever I'd go to those places, it made me more confident. It made me feel a lot better looking. It made you a lot better looking, by a long shot. And I had a friend that used to have a saying, go ugly early, you know, and I always wondered why I got hit on all the time, you know. Apparently everybody else had that motto too, but it was a lot of fun, you know, it was a lot of fun. And you know, it just, I don't know, that was about the only time that my drinking was what I thought was a lot of fun, and I didn't have too many consequences. But man, when I think about, I mean, I was 16 years old, 17 years old, driving the car, I fell asleep. I had this propensity to fall asleep whenever I drank, and so I'd, you know, like, drive down the guard. I don't know even how I managed to get through life. But anyway, so graduated high school relatively unscathed, went to college. I went to community college for a couple years, but I went to a four-year state university. And I signed up for a full semester of classes every semester for 2 years. Never once showed up to a class. Never once. So I spent thousands and thousands of the family dollars on college and never once showed up to a class. And it took me till I was about probably 8 years sober to admit that to everybody. I told everybody for a long time that I'd graduated college. I never even showed up to a class, let alone graduated. So, but, you know, I knew where all the gyms were and all the bars, and, you know, I was one of those people that anytime anybody wanted to go out to Waldo's for the happy hour or whatever, I was your man. I was definitely your man. And nobody caught on for a while, but, you know, that's what I did, and that's how I handled it. And somewhere in that, I mean, there's a lot of fun stories. There's a lot of, you know, I don't want to dwell too long on that. There's a lot of funny stories, some of them funny, some of them not so funny. You know, waking up in frat houses with someone else's underwear on and, you know, just stuff like that. You know, if you think those kind of things are funny. But, you know, in college you get away with it because everybody does it, you know. Or at least I thought everybody does it. Often I was the only girl in there, but apparently everybody else did it. But, you know, somewhere in there I crossed that invisible line, you know. And I can, looking back now, actually I think I even knew it then, but looking back now, I felt it, you know, I felt it where people, you know, like right around junior year, still never showed up to a class, right around junior year, all my friends started to take their classes a little more seriously and started looking towards getting out, you know, and graduating and moving on with their life, and I didn't, you know, I was all about partying, I was all about being there to drink, and again, you know, I mean, it started with blackouts, and I started having experiences like, you know, waking up in 7-Eleven parking lot at 4 o'clock in the morning with the car running and not remembering if I'd been in there already. Or if I had gotten back out, you know, the only way I could tell to look to see if they had a burrito wrapper on the, you know, on the seat. So it just, you know, stuff like that. And the people around me started to change a little bit. Like my vibe from them started to change. Like they started to not like me anymore. I don't know why. You know, I mean, I was stealing from them. I was crashing their cars. I was, you know, doing all those things, and they didn't like me. And I don't know why. So I did what any self-respecting alcoholic would do, and I took a trip. I took a trip out to California, and second I got off the plane, man, I was like, oh, I came to San Diego, and I was like, oh, yeah, this is it. This is it. So, you know, once I went back there, finished another semester, packed up my stuff and moved out here. I did a geographic, and I ran as far as I could till I ran out of land, and ended up here. And the funny thing was, I ended up on somebody's floor. I didn't know anybody here, not a soul here, but I ended up on the floor with this Navy ex-SEAL, not with him on the floor, but he moved at the same time. And, so he became my friend, my only friend, and he was an alcoholic and a drug addict, and I was introduced to crystal meth, which all of us know it's awful, awful. But that sort of helped me. I'm glad to have been introduced to that because it helped me start to spiral downward much faster. And, not knowing anybody here, not having any friends other than this guy, and we hated each other's guts, but we were the only ones that each other had. And so, we'd get in fist fights, it was just nuts, but he was my friend. And, over a period of time, a couple of years or whatever, I really truly started to spiral downward. And one day I just decided I had enough, and I had no idea that it had anything to do with alcohol or drugs. I really truly thought that it was a run of bad luck, bad people, bad drivers, bad circumstances, bad everything, it's just some crappy luck. And, no idea that it was drugs and alcohol. And that baffles me that it never occurred to me. But anyway, so one day I just decided that I'd had enough. I was tired and I had enough. And so I went I was living by myself at the time and went in and just covered. I was hungover to beat the band. It was like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Went and covered up myself with a whole bunch of clothes and crawled in the closet, parked my car down the street, shut all the windows, and just, I was going to go take the big sleep. And I just prayed that I did not wake up. Like, you're going to go to sleep and not wake up. that was my solution. Is just I was going to go to sleep, and damn it, that was going to be it. Sorry. And unfortunately, they found me, a couple days later. And, so I ended up, to his credit, this gentleman helped me get into my first treatment program. It took a while. While I was waiting, he got some direction from the counselors. It's pretty bad when you're a drug addict. Alcoholic friend says you need treatment, yeah, it's pretty bad. And this guy was bad. He was way worse than I was. And he thought I needed help, And so it took a couple days to get the whole ball rolling or whatever. And, so he came back from meeting with his counselor with a little slip of paper in his hand. And I still remember the handwriting. He said, this lady said, go to an AA meeting. It's on the corner of University and 30th. And I thought, why? Why would I do that? Why would anyone do that? It just did not occur to me. I didn't know what AA was about. I'd never heard of the 12 steps, nothing. And so I didn't, of course, I didn't go. And while I was laying on my couch waiting for someone to save me, I was watching one of the three channels I got at the time. And since I wasn't receptive to the idea of a 12-step program, God found a way to get it in front of me. And I was watching Sylvester and Tweety. I was watching the cartoons. And I don't know if you guys have ever seen it, but it's this episode came on where he is obsessed with eating Tweety Birds, and he can't stop. And the whole episode is about him trying to stop eating Tweety Birds. So all his alley cat friends, they have meetings, and they're his support group, and they help him stop eating Tweety Birds. So he finally does. Yeah, he finally does stop eating them, and he makes friends with the birds and everything. And he's holding one in his hand, and all of a sudden his eyes glaze over, and he just goes... he's off to the races again. And it is so funny. I've never to this day seen that episode again. And don't think I haven't tried, because I have tried to see that. But, it just cracks me up, because that was kind of God's way of doing that, of getting it in front of me. But obviously the irony was lost on me at the time. But so I went into treatment program. I had no intentions of getting sober again. No idea of that alcohol and drugs were my problem. I used to sneak out. They didn't give us sugar or caffeine in a treatment program. Who does that? Who would do that to an alcoholic? So I spent most of my time sneaking out, down to the nurse's station, eating coffee out of the jar, just anything because I needed it. And, that was my first exposure to AA, and I sat in the back of the room, and, a lot of the AA meetings I went to at the time had, that instant coffee. So I would eat it out of the jar by the spoonful. And then I'd lay there awake all night. anyway, so needless to say, it didn't take. I drank the day I got out. I literally the day I got out, somebody, my friend, picked me up, and he thought it'd be neat to bring a little bit of drugs as a celebration. And I had a couple beers and a couple lines, and I was good to go. And I could do it, you know. I could do it. And I figured, Father Terry actually said this on one of his tapes, but I just figured if it got bad again, I would just quit. You know, I would just quit doing that, whatever was making my life bad. And, yeah, it doesn't work that way. It does not work that way at all. And I spent 2 more years out there just, you know, I won't go into too much more detail about this, but I often sat there and wondered, you know, when I was feeling so lonely and just gutted, you know, like, how could it possibly get any worse? And it always did. You know, it always did. Something else would happen, you know, and it just kept getting worse. And so finally I reached, I think one of my crowning moments was driving to a job that I was not qualified for because I lied and said that I had all this marketing experience. You know, I had nothing. I worked at, like, I don't know, Cal stores or something. And so I lied about this job interview. So I was driving there after getting in a fist fight with my neighbors over a heroin deal. And driving there in a stolen car, I had blood down the front. This was my first day at work, and I had blood down the front of me driving in a stolen car. You know, it's like, whatever. That was a typical day. But anyway, second time in treatment, I did go back. I went back to the same treatment program. Never do that. Never do that. You know, it was the same counselors, same everybody. So I couldn't pull the wool over anyone's eyes this time around. And, you know, I was a little more serious this time. I was a little more serious. I just still quite wasn't there. I didn't get it that it was the drugs and alcohol, you know. And so I'd never tried to quit. I really didn't try to quit. And so I walked out of there and I thought, okay, this time I'm going to try to quit. And I couldn't, you know. That came as just such a big surprise to me that I couldn't quit. And the harder I tried to quit, the more desperate I drank, you know. And it was stuff like, I was in my sponsor's car going on a road trip up to Santa Monica, drinking beers in a duffel bag, you know, like in the back seat of my sponsor's car, you know. And I've always wanted to ask her if she ever knew, you know, about that. But anyway, and just stuff like that, you know. And it just became really desperate. And June 10th, 1990, I mean, I kept going to meetings. I was in PB at the time, and I kept going to meetings every day, and I'd raise my hand, and, you know, I'm a newcomer. And you know, I got 10 days, 20 days, you know, a couple 30 days, and I just couldn't get it. I could not grasp that it was actually for me or that it actually applied to me. And so June 10th, 1990, I got up. I was hungover, and I just kind of had that dismal resignation, like, you know what? I'm going to do it all over again tonight, you know, because I got up every morning going, okay, today's going to be different. Today's going to be really different. And every night I ended up with, you know, with the same thing. And I laughed at what Paul said too. Drinking and still in AA is the most miserable place to be. I tried to write a 4-step drunk, and, you know, I started out all nice and neat and everything, and by the end it was just like, you know, and these big block letters, and, you know, it was awful. But I woke up that morning and just, I didn't have it in me anymore to quit. You know, I couldn't quit. I just knew that I wasn't going to do it. You know, I was going to end up in the same spot. And so I just went through my day, and before I knew it, there was a couple days put together in a couple weeks, and it just started to happen, you know. And I stopped trying, I guess, was part of it. And right around 45 days or so, 50, it wasn't quite 60 days, but I had that dawning of this might work, you know, this just might work for me. And, you know, it just, I don't know, it was just that little tiny glimmer of hope. And that was enough to keep me going, you know. And I actually thought I might have a chance at this. And so I went to a lot of meetings. I went to, you know, at least one a day, sometimes two or three, because first of all, I didn't have any friends. And second of all, a lot of times they had free cake and coffee, you know. So I spent a lot of time at meetings. And, you know, I started to make some friends, you know. Or at least, you know, started to talk to some people and look and feel okay about interacting with some of you. And, you know, I had a couple of good sponsors. I had some great people. And if I can say anything about, you know, this program, the fact that we reach out and put our arms around newcomers is priceless. I mean, that is what kept me in the boat, definitely. And, you know, I've had the the opportunity to do that, and I could never give that enough of that back because that's what they did for me. But anyway, so I don't know. Somehow I got 90 days, and it turned into 6 months, and it just I started to figure out that okay, I can start taking this step, and through the help of a sponsor and other people in the program, I was able to start moving forward in this program. And I wasn't just there to eat the coffee or, drink the cake or do whatever I was doing there. I was actually going to put some effort into this. And I absolutely could not have done that myself. You people saved my life. And, as I started to work the steps, right around the fourth step, I was so angry. Oh my God, I was so angry. They tell you not to get too hungry, angry, lonely, tired. Didn't matter. If I was hungry, that made me angry. If I was tired, that made me angry, And if I was angry, that really pissed me off. That's all I felt was just this raw anger. And, that's all I could, I was violent, too. I had a few fist fights sober, too. I always lost, by the way. I never won any of those. I always lost. But I started, the one thing I did have, despite being so angry, and I wasn't angry, I don't know, I don't even know what the heck I was angry at. I just was angry. And, but the other feeling that I did have was willingness. I was willing to do what was suggested for the first time in my life. I don't know why it changed. It just did. And I did what sponsors told me. I did what other people told me. I hung around with alcoholics, and it started to work for me. It really started to work. And a big turning point for me was that first four step. And for 3 months, I put it off and bought all the right pens and all the right notebooks and, set the desk up, flowers on the desk and, coffee. And then I'd sit there and stare at it. And, I put it off for 3 months until I got to the point where I was so miserable. Everybody else was a lot more miserable than I was because I was so miserable. And, but I finally just grabbed, I think, a crayon and, a sheet of newspaper and just went down to the beach and just, put it all out there. And every once in a while I hear somebody that's kind of stalling on their fourth step, and I go, I've been there. But you'll get miserable enough, until you actually do something about it. But that was just such a huge turning point for me. 18 pages of legal paper, front and back. So my first fourth step, I'm pretty sure she fell asleep, but, we sat by the fire. It was really nice, and then we burned it afterwards. And it truly was, a step into the sunlight for me. And I kind of wish I hadn't burned it. I don't really recommend that because there are a few people on there that I think I still owe amends to. And, oh, well, I don't know their names anymore. But it'll come around. It'll come around. But anyway, so big, it was a big step. And then I proceeded to move on to the eighth and ninth. And I have to say something really important. I skimmed over the sixth and seventh step. And I went right into my eighth and ninth and started making amends. And, my sponsor, I had a sponsor who helped me through it, but I just didn't do much on the sixth and seventh. And, I can tell you now, I've done that a couple times now where I've, put a lot of effort into the sixth and seventh, and that has increased the quality of my sobriety tenfold. But I didn't do it at the time anyway. So, I got to my amends. People, the amazing thing to me was I was standing on people's doorsteps that I vowed if I ever saw again, I would kill. Or be killed, one of the two. And, I was making these amends to people that just, it just blew me away. I was apologizing for stealing hundreds of dollars. I was apologizing for stealing jewelry and, all the stuff, that I was actually facing for the first time in my life. And, I got a lot of different responses. I got everything from, I got the cold stare and, drop dead look. And never said a word. He just walked away. Anyway, so there was that response, and he'll go on another four step again, I'm sure. No. And I had other responses where this girl listened to me for like 20 minutes, and I'm pouring out my heart and soul, telling her how sorry I am. She goes, I'm just so grateful you're not here to sell me Amway. She had no idea what I was talking about, but she was just happy I didn't sell her Amway, So, ex-boyfriends. I did one where I went to a grocery. I used to steal from grocery stores. Stealing was my thing. I used to steal from grocery stores all the time. I had my letter jacket from high school, and I'd stuff like pounds of butter, you know, and like all kinds of wacky stuff in the sleeves, and I'd walk out like this, and nobody ever stopped me. You know, I still can't believe that to this day. But anyway, so 20 years later, I go back and, you know, talk to the store manager and apologize and offer to start financial amends, and he was like 19 with zits, and he goes, why would you do that? You know, why would you come back here and tell me that, you know? And so anyway, point being is that I got a lot of different responses on my amends, but it didn't matter. You know, what mattered was that I faced them, you know, that I started cleaning up the wreckage. And it's just such a crucial part of sobriety. And, you know, on and on we go. And you know, here I am almost 19 years later. And, you know, I've been through the steps a number of times. Like right around 5 years, I kind of got into that comfortable zone of, I'm watching my time. Okay. Got into that comfortable zone of, you know, kind of getting out of the muck and the darkness of the disease and kind of getting to a real functional place for the first time in my life. I can't even say I got my life back because I really didn't have one before, but I got, you know, I really was able to build a nice life for myself, keep a job and have friends and, you know, a relationship and all this stuff. And I got the opportunity to do my dream job, which was camping adventure tours. You know, I just throw all my stuff in a duffel bag and hit the road. And I did that for almost 6 years. And I bring that up because it was a really big, another big turning point in my sobriety, because it took me away from meetings. You know, I traveled all over the continent, Canada, Alaska, Mexico, a lot of remote places. So it took me away from my support group. And that was the first time, for the longest time, you know, for those first 5 years, meetings were my higher power, definitely. They were my higher power. I knew there was a God. I believed in, well, I don't really say I believed in God. I knew there was a God. I just didn't really believe. I didn't have much of a relationship with them. The meetings were definitely my higher power. So that was it. That was big for me to step out of that comfort zone. And, you know, that really helped me to develop a different relationship with a higher power. And, you know, so I still use my support group. I still went to meetings. I mean, I went to some meetings on Indian reservations, you know, down in Mexico, where I didn't understand a word they were saying, but, man, they were happy. And, you know, it was just really cool, just some really amazing experiences. And I never lost my willingness. You know, I'm so grateful for that because, I mean, I'd go months without a meeting. And, you know, so I'm grateful that I didn't lose that. And I managed to come back, settled back down here in San Diego in 2000, and, you know, just kind of snuggled right back into Pacific Beach and really just kind of got my life back, went back to my old meetings, you know, a lot of my old friends and all that, and it was great. And then I had a little setback. I met and married another alcoholic. I'm just kidding. I did meet and marry another alcoholic, sober alcoholic, and, you know, that truly has been an amazing part of my sobriety. I married a wonderful man who has just a little bit more time than I do, darn little. You know, we met. I don't know, it was like love at third or fourth sight or something like that. I watched him date around the room that, you know, the AA meeting that we both went to, and then finally got to me, and so we had a great time. So you know, but it was love right off the bat, and you know, but it was a typical alcoholic relationship. Move outs and all that, and that was like the first week, you know. And you know, it just somehow God saw fit to keep us together. And you know, we've been married 6.5 years now, and that, my friends, is kind of an accomplishment in sobriety. He's a wonderful man. He's sitting right over there, and you know, I'm grateful for him. We've learned so much because of each other, and in spite of each other, and you know. All that, it's great to have a partner in sobriety, and, you know, I'm really grateful for that. I've had a couple other challenges that have come along. One is Molly, who's 2.5, and one is Olivia, who's 5. I'm an alcoholic that did not want kids, or didn't think I wanted kids. I just was way too selfish for that, and, you know, it's turned out to be an amazing experience, you know, and I need God's help through that, definitely. I need God's help through that, and, you know, just kind of to wrap it up, you know, as far as, you know, my sobriety now, I am, you know, my relationship with the higher power has changed so drastically and in such a good way. You know, back when I said there were times where I thought I didn't understand how my life could get worse, you know, when it was so bad and it just kept getting worse, the opposite is true. You know, I mean, all these years, each phase I've gone through has gotten better. And then, like, the next one comes along, and I think, wow, you know, it just keeps getting better and better, and it baffles me how much better it gets, you know. And one of the, I mean, not just material things, although that new car is pretty nice, rather than sleeping in some 1970 Volvo that wasn't even mine. But, you know, it's the material things are nice, but it's more the spiritual connection. And, you know, I have a relationship with a higher power now that goes beyond anything I could have ever imagined. And I didn't get that. I mean, I tried so many different things to deepen that. I mean, I tried Eastern religions. I've been saved a number of times, you know, at different churches. I'm pretty sure I'm banned from most of them now. But, you know, I've tried yoga. I've tried, yeah, you name it. You know, just try to get closer to God. And the thing that's brought me the closest to God and helped me with my understanding of God is being in meetings. Because when you're in meetings and you stay connected and be of service and be active in the program, God comes to you in different ways. Sometimes it's through people. Sometimes it's through opportunities. Sometimes it's through books. I just read the book, The Shack. That was like, oh, life-changing. You know, but it was all about a relationship with God. You know, so just being here and being willing and being a part of has been, is what's helped me, you know, get to the point now. You know, and I'm nowhere near done. You know, I'm nowhere near done. And, you know, but I've been lucky enough to sponsor people. I have a great sponsor. My sponsor's here. You know, I've been lucky enough to sponsor women, and I just try to stay close. All these years, and I am more willing now than I ever have been to work the program. And it's strictly because I keep coming to meetings. I definitely keep coming to meetings. That's just such a big part of it. And, you know, I don't know, just stay close. But I appreciate you guys listening. You know, I do want to read, I didn't even look at these. That's pretty cool. But I do want to read the promises, and then I'll wrap it up. From my point of view, you know, we all have heard the promises, but these are the promises as I see them now. With the help of your patient and loving guidance, I've been painstaking about this phase of my development. And let me tell you, I've been more than amazed before I'm even halfway through. Thanks to you all, I now know a new freedom and a new happiness that goes beyond definition. Because of your gracious forgiveness, I do not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. I now recognize serenity and have known peace. Because of how far down the scale we have gone, our experiences still continue to help others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity frequently raises its ugly head, but because of steps 6 through 10, I can make it disappear for a while. I can't say I've lost interest in selfish things, but I have gained interest in my fellows. I've gotten much more selective at self-seeking. Sometimes it even involves others. Thanks to seeing you guys about anywhere from 3 to 5 times a week, my whole attitude and outlook upon life continually changes. I now only fear really mean people and the current economic situation. That one would scare anyone, I'm sorry. But with the help of my higher power, I can now handle situations that used to baffle me. I now fully understand that God is doing for me what I could never do for myself. Are these extravagant promises? I used to think so. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes slowly, but always quicker than when I was drinking. God has been gracious in allowing an infinite number of them to materialize in my life. Thank you to all of you for my life and my sobriety. Please know that I am here for you as you've been here for me. So thank you for listening.